It had been thorough but not skilled. I had it loose within a minute and the catch undone. The wicker chest was filled with pictures, bundles of loose drawings done in pencil, ink and charcoal, neatly tied with faded ribbons of coloured silk, several bound sketchbooks, and a number of paintings, a few large unframed squares, and two smaller boxes of miniatures, all framed, stacked on edge like a deck of cards. I heard Jocasta sigh above me and looked up. She stood still, eyes closed, and I could tell that she was inhaling deeply, breathing in the smell of the pictures, the smell of oils and charcoal, gesso, paper, canvas, linseed and turpentine, a full-bodied ghost that floated out of its wicker casket, transparently vivid against the background scents of straw and dust, wood and wicker. Her fingers curled, thumb rubbing against the tips of her other fingers, unconsciously rolling a brush between them. I had seen Bree do that, now and then, looking at something she wanted to paint. Jocasta sighed again, then opened her eyes and knelt down beside me, reaching in to run her fingers lightly over the cache of buried art, searching. "The oils," she said, "fetch those out." I'd already taken out the boxes of miniatures. Jamie squatted on the other side of the casket, lifting the bundles of loose drawings and the sketchbooks, so that I could pull out the larger oils, laid on edge along the side of the container. "A portrait," she said, head on one side to listen to the flat, hollow sound as I laid each one against the side of the wicker box. "An old man." It was plain which one she meant. Two of the large canvases were landscapes, three portraits. I recognized Farquhar Campbell, much younger than his present age, and what must be a self-portrait of Jocasta herself, done perhaps 20 years before. I had no time to look at these, though, interesting as they were. The third portrait looked to have been done much more recently than the others, and showed the effects of Jocasta's failing eyesight. The edges were blurred, the colours muddy, shapes just slightly distorted, so that the elderly gentleman, who looked out of the clouded oil, seemed somehow disturbing, as though he belonged to some race not quite human, in spite of the orthodoxy of his wig and high white stock. He wore a black coat and waistcoat, old-fashioned in style, with the folds of a tartan plaid draped over his shoulder, caught up with a brooch whose golden gleam was echoed by the ornamental knurl atop the dirk the old man held, his fingers bent and gnarled with arthritis. I recognized that dirk.
"So that is Hector Cameron."
Jamie recognized it too. He looked at the painting with fascination. Jocasta reached out a hand, touching the surface of the paint as though to identify it by touch.
"Aye, that's him," she said dryly. "Never saw him in life, did you, nephew?"
Jamie shook his head.
"Once, perhaps, but I was nae more than a babe at the time."
His gaze traced the old man's features with deep interest, as though looking for clues to Hector Cameron's character. Such clues were evident. The man's force of personality fairly vibrated from the canvas. He had strong bones, the man in the portrait, though the flesh hung from them in the infirmity of age. The eyes were still sharp, but one was half closed. It might have been only a drooping eyelid caused by a small stroke, but the impression was that of an habitual manner of looking at the world, one eye always narrowed in cynical appraisal. Jocasta was searching through the contents of the chest, fingers darting lightly here and there like hunting moths. She touched one box of miniatures and lifted it with a small grunt of satisfaction. She ran a finger slowly along the edge of each miniature, and I saw that the frames were patterned differently, squares and ovals, smooth gilded wood, tarnished silver laid in a rope border, another studded with tiny rosettes. She found one she recognized and plucked it from the box, handing it absently to me as she went back to her search. The miniature was also of Hector Cameron, but this portrait done many years before the other. Dark wavy hair lay loose on his shoulders, a small ornamental braid down one side, sporting two grouse's feathers in the ancient Highland style. The same solid bones were there, but the flesh was firm. He had been handsome, Hector Cameron. It was an habitual expression. Whether by inclination or accident of birth, the right eye was narrowed here as well, though not as much as in the older portrait. My scrutiny was interrupted by Jocasta, who laid a hand on my arm. "Is this the lass?" she asked, thrusting another of the miniatures at me. I took it, puzzled, and gasped when I turned it over. It was Phaedra, done when the girl was in her early teens. Her usual cap was missing. She wore a simple kerchief bound over her hair that threw the bones of her face into bold relief. Hector Cameron's bones. Jocasta nudged the box of paintings with her foot.
"Give those to your daughter, nephew. Tell her to paint them over. It would be a shame to waste the canvas."
Without waiting for response, she set off back toward the house alone, hesitating only briefly at the fork in the path, steering by scent and memory. There was a profound silence in the wake of Jocasta's departure, broken only by the singing of a mockingbird in a nearby pine.
"I will be damned,"
Jamie said at last, taking his eyes off the figure of his aunt as she vanished into the house alone. He didn't look shocked so much as deeply bemused.
"Did the girl know, do you think?"
"Almost certainly," I said.
"The slaves would surely have known. Some must have been here when she was born."
"They'd have told her, if she wasn't quick enough to have worked it out herself.
And I certainly think she is."
He nodded and leaned back against the wall of the carriage house, looking meditatively down his long nose at the wicker chest of paintings. I felt a strong reluctance to go back to the house myself. The buildings were beautiful, a mellow gold in the late fall sun, and the grounds were peaceful, well-ordered. The sound of cheerful voices came from the kitchen garden. Several horses grazed contentedly in the paddock nearby. And far away, down the distant Silver River, a small boat came down, a four-oared pirata, its oars stroking the surface, brisk and graceful as a water strider.
"Where every prospect pleases, and only man is vile," I remarked.
Jamie gave me a brief glance of incomprehension, then returned to his thoughts. So, Jocasta would by no means sell Phaedra, and thought Phaedra knew it. I wondered exactly why.
Because she felt some duty to the girl, as the child of her husband, or as a subtle form of revenge on that long-dead husband, keeping his illegitimate daughter as a slave, a body servant.
I suppose that the two were not entirely exclusive, come to that. I had known Jocasta long enough to realize that her motives were rarely simple. There was a chill in the air, with the sun low in the sky. I leaned against the carriage house beside Jamie, feeling the stored warmth of the sun soak from its bricks into my body, and wished that we could step into the old farm wagon and drive post-haste back to the ridge, leaving River Run to deal with its own legacies of bitterness. But the note was in my pocket, crackling when I moved. "You come." Not an appeal I could dismiss. But I had come. And now what? Jamie straightened suddenly, looking toward the river. I looked too, and saw that the boat had drawn into the dock there. A tall figure sprang up onto the dock, then turned to help another out of the boat. The second man was shorter, and moved in an odd fashion, off-kilter and out of rhythm. "Duncan," I said at once, seeing this, "and Ulysses, they're back."
"Aye," Jamie said, taking my arm and starting toward the house. "But they haven't found her."
Runaway or stolen on the 31st of October, a negro wench, 22 years of age, above middling height, and comely in appearance, with a scar on the left forearm in the shape of an oval, caused by a burn. Dressed in an indigo gown with a green-striped apron, white cap, brown stockings and leather shoes. No missing teeth. Known by the name of Phaedri. Communicate particulars to D. Innes, River Run Plantation, in the vicinity of Cross Creek. Substantial reward will be paid for good information. I smoothed the crumpled broadsheet, which also sported a crude drawing of Phaedra, looking vaguely cross-eyed. Duncan had emptied his pockets and dropped a handful of these sheets on the table in the hall when he had come in the afternoon before, exhausted and dispirited. They had, he said, posted the bills in every tavern and public house between Campbellton and Wilmington, making inquiries as they went, but to no avail. Phaedra had vanished like the dew. "May I have the marmalade, please?" Jamie and I were taking breakfast alone, neither Jocasta nor Duncan having appeared this morning. I was enjoying it, despite the gloomy atmosphere. Breakfast at River Run was normally a lavish affair, extending even to a pot of real tea. Jocasta must be paying her pet smuggler an absolute fortune for it. There was none to be found between Virginia and Georgia, to the best of my knowledge. Jamie was frowning at another of the broadsheets, deep in thought. He didn't take his eyes off it, but his hand roamed vaguely over the table, settled on the cream jug, and passed it across to me. Ulysses, showing little sign of his long journey beyond a certain heaviness of the eyes, stepped silently forward, took the cream jug, replaced it neatly, and set the pot of marmalade beside my plate. "Thank you," I said, and he graciously inclined his head.
"Will you require further bloaters, madam?" he inquired, "or more ham?"
I shook my head, my mouth being full of toast, and he glided off, picking up a loaded tray by the door, this presumably intended for Jocasta, Duncan, or both. Jamie watched him go with a sort of abstracted expression.
"I've been thinking, Sassenach," he said.
"I would never have guessed it," I assured him. "About what?" He looked momentarily surprised, but then smiled, realizing.
"I ken what I told you, Sassenach, about Brianna and the widow McCullum, that she wouldna scruple long to act if Roger Mac were to be taking heed where he shouldn't."
"I do," I said. He nodded, as though verifying something to himself.
"Well, the lass comes by it honestly enough. The Mackenzies of Leoch are proud as Lucifer, all of them, and black jealous with it. You dinna want to cross one, still less to betray one."
I regarded him warily over my cup of tea, wondering where this was leading. "I thought their defining trait was charm, allied with cunning.
And as for betrayal, both your uncles were past hands at it." "The two go together, do they not?" he asked, reaching across to dip a spoon in the marmalade. "You must beguile someone before you can betray them, no? And I'm inclined to think that a man who would betray is all the quicker to resent betrayal himself. Or a woman," he added delicately.
"Oh, really?" I said, sipping with pleasure. "Jocasta, you mean?" Put in those terms, I could see it. The Mackenzies of Leoch had powerful personalities. I did wonder what Jamie's maternal grandfather, the notorious Red Jacob, had been like, and I'd noted small commonalities of behaviour between Jocasta and her elder brothers before. Colum and Dougal had had an unshakable loyalty to each other, but to no one else, and Jocasta was essentially alone, separated from her family since her first marriage at 15. Being a woman, it was natural that the charm should be more apparent in her, but that didn't mean the cunning wasn't there. Nor yet the jealousy, I supposed. Well, plainly she knew that Hector betrayed her. And I do wonder whether she painted that portrait of Phaedra as a means of indicating to the world at large that she knew it, or merely as a private message to Hector. But what has that got to do with the present situation? He shook his head.
Not Hector, he said. Duncan.
I stared at him, absolutely open-mouthed. All other considerations aside, Duncan was impotent. He had told Jamie so on the eve of his wedding to Jocasta. Jamie smiled crookedly, and reaching across the table, put a thumb under my chin and pushed my mouth gently shut.
It's a thought, Sassenach, is all I'm saying. But I think I must go and have a word with the man. Will you come?
Duncan was in the small room he used as a private office, tucked away above the stables, along with the tiny rooms that housed the grooms and stable lads. He was slumped in a chair, looking hopelessly at the untidy stacks of papers and undusted ledgers that had accumulated on every horizontal surface. He looked desperately tired, and a great deal older than when I had last seen him at Flora MacDonald's barbecue. His grey hair was thinning, and when he turned to greet us, the light of the sun shone across his face, and I saw the thin line of the hare-lip scar Roger had mentioned, hidden in the luxuriant growth of his moustache. Something vital seemed to have gone out of him, and when Jamie delicately broached the subject upon which we had come, he made no attempt at all to deny it. In fact, he seemed glad, rather than otherwise, to have it out.
"You did lie with the lass, then, Duncan?" Jamie asked directly, wanting to have the fact established. "Well, no," he said vaguely. "I should have liked to, of course, but what we are sleeping in Joe's dressing-room."
At this reference to his wife, his face flushed a deep, unhealthy red.
"I mean, you've had carnal knowledge of the woman, have you not?"
Jamie said, keeping a grip on his patience.
"Oh, aye," he gulped. I did."
"How?" I asked bluntly. The flush deepened to such a degree that I feared he might have an apoplexy on the spot. He breathed like a grampus for a bit, though, and finally his complexion began to fade back to something like normal.
"She fed me," he said at last, rubbing a hand tiredly across his eyes. "Every day."
Jocasta rose late and breakfasted in her sitting-room, attended by Ulysses, to make plans for the day. Duncan, who had risen before dawn every day of his life, usually in the expectation of a dry crust, or at most a bit of drammach, oatmeal mixed with water, woke now to find a steaming pot of tea beside his bed, accompanied by a bowl of creamy porridge, liberally garnished with honey and cream, toast drenched in butter, eggs fried with ham. "Sometimes a wee fish, rolled in cornmeal, crisp and sweet," he added, with mournful reminiscence.
"Aye, that's very seductive, to be sure, Duncan," Jamie said, not without sympathy. "A man's vulnerable when he's hungry."
He gave me a wry glance, but still. Duncan had been grateful to Fed for her kindness, and had, being a man after all, admired her beauty, though in a purely disinterested sort of way, he assured us.
"To be sure," Jamie said, with marked scepticism. "What happened?"
"Duncan had dropped the butter," was the answer, whilst struggling to butter his toast one-handed. Fed had hastened to retrieve the pieces of the fallen dish, and then hurried to fetch a cloth and wipe the streaks of butter from the floor, and then from Duncan's chest.
"Well, I was in my nightshirt," he murmured, starting to go red again. "And she was... she had..."
His hand rose and made vague motions in the vicinity of his chest, which I took to indicate that Phaedra's bodice had displayed her bosom to particular advantage while in such close proximity to him.
"And?"
Jamie prompted ruthlessly. And, it appeared, Duncan's anatomy had taken note of the fact, a circumstance admitted with such strangulated modesty that we could barely hear him.
"But I thought you couldn't," I began.
"Oh, I couldna," he assured me hastily. "Only at night, like dreaming, but not waking, not since I had the accident. Perhaps it was being so early in the morning, My cock thought I was still asleep.
Jamie made a low Scottish noise, expressing considerable doubt as to this supposition, but urged Duncan to continue with a certain amount of impatience.
Fed had taken notice in her turn, it transpired.
She was only sorry for me, Duncan said frankly. I could tell as much. But she put her hand on me. Soft. So soft, he repeated, almost inaudibly.
He'd been sitting on his bed, and had gone on sitting there in dumb amazement, as she took away the breakfast tray, lifted his nightshirt, climbed on the bed with her skirts neatly tucked above her round brown thighs, and with great tenderness and gentleness had welcomed back his manhood.
"Once?" Jamie demanded. "Or did you keep doing it?"
Duncan put his head in his hand, a fairly eloquent admission under the circumstances.
"How long did this, liaison go on?" I asked, more gently.
2 months, perhaps 3. "Not every day," he hastened to add, "only now and then. And they had been very careful. I wouldn't ever have wanted to shame Joe, Ken," he said very earnestly. "And I can't wheel I shouldn't be doing it. 'Twas a great sin, and yet I couldn't keep from—"
He broke off, swallowing. "It's all my fault what's happened. Let the sin be on me. Och, my poor darling lass."
He fell silent, shaking his head like an old, sad, flea-ridden dog. I felt terribly sorry for him, regardless of the morality of the situation. The collar of his shirt was turned awkwardly under, strands of his grizzled hair trapped beneath its coat. I gently pulled them out and straightened it, though he took no heed.
"Do you think she's dead, Duncan?" Jamie asked quietly,
and Duncan blanched, his skin going the same grey as his hair.
"I cannot bring myself to think it, MacDoo," he said,
and his eyes filled with tears.
And yet—"
Jamie and I exchanged uneasy glances. "And yet, Fed had taken no money when she disappeared. How could a female slave travel very far without detection, advertised and hunted, lacking a horse, money, or anything beyond a pair of leather shoes? A man might possibly make it to the mountains and manage to survive in the woods if he were tough and resourceful. But a girl, a house slave. Someone had taken her, or else she was dead. None of us wanted to voice that thought, though. Jamie heaved a great sigh, and, taking a clean handkerchief from his sleeve, put it in Duncan's hand.
"I shall pray for her, Duncan, wherever she may be. And for you, Harridge. And for you."
Duncan nodded, not looking up, the handkerchief clutched tight. It was clear that any attempt at comfort would be futile. And so at last we left him, sitting there, in his tiny, landlocked room, so far from the sea. We made our way back slowly, not speaking, but holding hands, feeling the strong need to touch each other. The day was bright, but there was a storm coming up. Ragged clouds were streaming in from the east, and the breeze came in gusts that whirled my skirts about like a twirling parasol. The wind was less on the back terrace, sheltered as it was by its waist-high wall. Looking up from here, I could just see the window that Phèdre had been looking out of when I'd found her there, the night of the barbecue. "She told me that something wasn't right," I said, "the night of Mrs. MacDonald's barbecue. Something was troubling her then." Jamie shot me an interested glance.
"Why? But you didn't mean Duncan, surely?"
he objected. "I know," I shrugged helplessly. "She didn't seem to know what was wrong herself. She just kept saying, 'Something ain't right.'" Jamie took a deep breath and blew it out again, shaking his head.
"In a way, I suppose I hope that whatever it was, it had to do with her going. For if it wasn't to do with her and Duncan—"
He trailed off, but I had no difficulty in finishing the thought. Then it wasn't to do with your aunt, either, I said. Jamie, do you really think Jocasta might have had her killed?
It should have sounded ridiculous, spoken aloud like that.
The horrible thing was that it didn't.
Jamie made that small shrugging gesture he used when very uncomfortable about something, as though his coat was too tight.
Had she her sight, I should think it possible, at least, he said, to be betrayed by Hector. And she blamed him already for the death of her girls. So her daughters are dead, but there is Phaedra, alive, every day a constant reminder of insult. And then to be betrayed yet again, by Duncan, with Hector's daughter.
He rubbed a knuckle under his nose.
As you think any woman of spirit might be moved?
Yes, I said,
imagining what I might think or feel under the same circumstances.
Certainly. But to murder?
That is what we're talking about, isn't it? Couldn't she simply have sold the girl?
No, he said thoughtfully. She couldn't. We made provision to safeguard her money when she wed, but not the property. Duncan is the owner of River Run, and all that goes with it.
Including Phaedra. I felt hollow and a little sick.
As I said, had she her sight, I shouldn't be astonished at all by the thought, as it is.
Ulysses, I said with certainty, and he nodded reluctantly. Ulysses wasn't only Jocasta's eyes, but her hands as well. I didn't think he would have killed Phaedra at his mistress's command, but if Jocasta had poisoned the girl, for instance, Ulysses might certainly have helped to dispose of the body.
I felt an odd air of unreality, even with what I knew of the Mackenzie family, calmly discussing the possibility of Jamie's aged aunt having murdered someone. And yet, I did know the Mackenzies.
If my aunt had any hand at all in the matter, Jamie said. After all, Duncan said they were discreet. And it may be the lass was taken off, perhaps by the man my aunt recalls from Coigach. It could be he'd think Phaedra might help him to the gold, no?
That was a somewhat happier thought. And it did fit with Phaedra's premonition, if that's what it was, which had occurred the same day that the man from Coigach came.
"I suppose all we can do is pray for her, poor thing," I said.
"I don't suppose there's a patron saint of abducted persons, is there?"
"Saint Dagobert," he said promptly, causing me to stare at him.
"You're making that up."
"Indeed I am not," he said with dignity. "Saint Athaleus is another one. And perhaps better now, I think. She was a young Roman lass who was abducted by the Emperor Justinian, who wished to have his way with her, and she vowed to chastity. But she escaped, and went off to live with her uncle in Benevento."
"Good for her. And Saint Dagobert?"
"A king of some sort, Frankish. Anyway, his guardian took against him as a child, and had him kidnapped away to England, so that the guardian's son might reign instead."
"Where do you learn these things?" I demanded.
"From Brother Polycarp at the Abbey of St. Anne," he said, the corner of his mouth tucking back in a smile. "When I couldn't sleep, he'd come and tell me stories of the saints hours on end. It didn't always put me to sleep, but after an hour or so of hearing about holy martyrs having their breasts amputated or being flogged with iron hooks, I'd close my eyes and make a decent pretense of it."
Jamie took my cap off and set it on the ledge. The air blew through my inch of hair, ruffling it like meadow grass, and he smiled as he looked at me.
"You look like a boy, Sassenach," he said, "though damned if I've ever seen a lad with an arse like yours."
"Thanks so much," I said, absurdly pleased. I had eaten like a horse in the last 2 months, slept well and deeply through the nights, and knew I was much improved in looks, hair notwithstanding. "Never hurt to hear it, though."
"I want you very much, Munian Down," he said softly,
and curled his fingers round my wrist, letting the pads rest gently on my pulse. "So the Mackenzies of Leoch are all prone to black jealousy," I said. I could feel my pulse steady under his fingers. Charming, cunning, and given to betrayal. I touched his lip, ran my thumb lightly along it, the tiny prickles of beard pleasant to the touch. "All of them?" He looked down, fixing me suddenly with a dark blue gaze in which humour and ruefulness were mingled with a good many other things I couldn't read.
"You think I am not?" he said,
and smiled a little sadly.
"God and Mary bless you, Sassenach,"
and bent to kiss me. We couldn't tarry at River Run. The fields down here on the Piedmont had long since been harvested and turned under, the remnants of dried stalks flecking the fresh dark earth. Snow would fly soon in the mountains. We had discussed the matter round and round, but came to no useful conclusion. There was nothing further we could do to help Phedre, except to pray. Beyond that, though, there was Duncan to think of. For it had occurred to both of us that if Jocasta had found out about his liaison with Phedre, her wrath wasn't likely to be limited to the slave girl. She might bide her time, but she wouldn't forget the injury. I'd never met a Scot who would. We took our leave of Jocasta after breakfast the next day, finding her in her private parlour, embroidering a table runner. The basket of silk threads sat in her lap, the colours carefully arrayed in a spiral so that she could choose the one she wanted by touch, and the finished linen fell to one side, 5 feet of cloth edged with an intricate design of apples, leaves, and vines. Or no, I realised when I picked up the end of the cloth to admire it. Not vines. Black-eyed serpents, coiling slyly, slithering, green and scaly. Here and there one gaped to show its fangs, guarding scattered red fruit. "Garden of Eden," she explained to me, rubbing the design lightly betwixt her fingers. "How beautiful," I said, wondering how long she'd been working on it. Had she begun it before Phedra's disappearance? A bit of casual talk. Then Josh the groom appeared to say that our horses were ready. Jamie nodded, dismissing him, and stood.
"Aunt," he said to Jocasta, matter-of-factly, "I should take it very much amiss were any harm to come to Duncan."
She stiffened, fingers halting in their work.
"Why should any harm come to him?" she asked, lifting her chin.
Jamie didn't reply at once, but stood regarding her, not without sympathy. Then he leaned down so that she could feel his presence close, his mouth near her ear.
"I know, Aunt," he said softly, "and if you dinna wish anyone else to share that knowledge, then I think I shall find Duncan in good health when I return."
She sat as though turned to salt. Jamie stood up, nodding toward the door, and we took our leave. I glanced back from the hallway and saw her still sitting like a statue, face as white as the linen in her hands, and the little balls of coloured thread all fallen from her lap, unravelling across the polished floor. Chapter 73 Double Dealing. With Marsali gone, the whisky-making became more difficult. Among us, Bree and Mrs. Bug and I had managed to get off one more malting before the weather became too cold and rainy, but it was a near thing, and it was with great relief that I saw the last of the malted grain safely decanted into the still. Once set to ferment, the stuff became Jamie's responsibility, as he trusted no one else with the delicate job of judging taste and proof. The fire beneath the still had to be kept at exactly the right level, though, to keep fermentation going without killing the mash, then raised for the distilling once fermentation was complete. This meant that he lived and slept beside the still for the few days necessary for each batch to come off. I generally brought him supper and stayed until the dark came, but it was lonely without him in my bed, and I was more than pleased when we poured the last of the new making into casks.
Oh, that smells good. I sniffed beatifically at the inside of an empty cask.
It was one of the special casks Jamie had obtained through one of Lord John's shipping friends. Charred inside, like a normal whiskey cask, but previously used to store sherry. The sweet, mellow ghost of the sherry mingled with the faint scent of char, and the hot, raw reek of the new whiskey were together enough to make my head spin pleasantly.
"Aye, it's a small batch, but no bad," Jamie agreed, inhaling the aroma like a perfume connoisseur.
He lifted his head and eyed the sky overhead. The wind was coming up strong, and thick clouds were racing past, dark-bellied and threatening.
"There's only the three casks," he said. "If you think you might manage one, Sassenach, I'll take the others. I should like to have them safe, rather than dig them out of a snowbank next week."
A half-mile walk in a roaring wind, carrying or rolling a 6-gallon cask, was no joke. But he was right about the snow. It wasn't quite cold enough for snow yet, but it would be soon. I sighed, but nodded, and between us we managed to lug the cask slowly up to the whiskey cache, hidden among rocks and ragged grapevines. I had quite regained my strength, but even so every muscle I had was trembling and jerking in protest by the time we had finished, and I made no objection at all when Jamie made me sit down to rest before heading back to the house.
"What do you plan to do with these?" I asked, nodding back toward the cache. "Keep or sell?"
He wiped a flying strand of hair out of his face, squinting against a blast of flying dust and dead leaves.
"I'll have to sell one for the spring seed. We'll keep one to age. And I think perhaps I can put the last to good purpose. If Bobby Higgins comes again before the snow, I shall send a half dozen bottles to Ash, Harnett, and Howe, and a few others. A wee token of my abiding esteem, aye?"
He grinned wryly at me. "Well, I've heard of worse bona fides," I said, amused.
It had taken him a good deal of work to worm his way back into the good graces of the North Carolina Committee of Correspondence. But several members had begun answering his letters again, cautiously, but with respect.
"I shouldn't think anything important will happen over the winter," he said thoughtfully, rubbing his cold, reddened nose.
"Likely not."
Massachusetts, where most of the uproar had been taking place, was now occupied by a General Gage, and the latest we had heard was that he had fortified Boston Neck, the narrow spit of land that connects the city to the mainland, which meant that Boston was now cut off from the rest of the colony and under siege. I felt a small pang thinking of it. I had lived in Boston for nearly 20 years and was fond of the city, though I knew I wouldn't recognize it now.
"John Hancock, he's a merchant there, is heading the Committee of Safety, Ash says. They voted to recruit 12,000 militia and are looking to purchase 5,000 muskets. With the trouble I had to find 30, good luck to them is all I can say."
I laughed, but before I could reply, Jamie stiffened.
"What's that?"
His head turned sharply, and he laid a hand on my arm. Silenced abruptly, I held my breath, listening. The wind stirred the drying leaves of wild grapevines with a papery rustle behind me, and in the distance a murder of crows passed, squabbling in shrill cries. Then I heard it too, a small, desolate, and very human sound. Jamie was already on his feet, making his way with care between the fallen rocks. He ducked beneath the lintel made by a leaning slab of granite, and I made to follow him. He stopped abruptly, nearly making me run into him.
"Joseph," he said, incredulously.
I peered around him as best I could. To my equal astonishment, it was Mr. Weems, sitting hunched on a boulder, a stone jug between his bony knees. He'd been crying. His nose and eyes were red, making him look even more like a white mouse than usual. He was also extremely drunk.
"Oh,"
he said, blinking in dismay at us.
Oh.
Are you quite well, Joseph?
Jamie came closer, extending a hand gingerly, as though afraid that Mr. Weems might crack into pieces if touched. This instinct was sound. When he touched the little man, Mr. Weems's face crumpled like paper, and his thin shoulders began to shake uncontrollably.
"I am so sorry, sir,"
he kept saying, quite dissolved in tears.
"I'm so sorry."
Jamie gave me a "do something, Sassenach" look of appeal, and I knelt swiftly, putting my arms round Mr. Weems's shoulders, patting his slender back. "Now, now," I said, giving Jamie a "now what" sort of look over Mr. Weems's matchstick shoulder in return. "I'm sure it will be all right."
"Oh, no," he said, hiccuping. "Oh, no, it can't."
He turned a face streaming with woe toward Jamie.
"I can't bear it, sir. Truly, I can't."
Mr. Weems' bones felt thin and brittle, and he was shivering. He was wearing only a thin shirt and breeches, and the wind was beginning to whine through the rocks. Clouds thickened overhead, and the light went from the little hollow suddenly, as though a blackout curtain had been dropped. Jamie unfastened his own cloak and wrapped it rather awkwardly round Mr. Weems, then lowered himself carefully onto another boulder.
"Tell me the trouble, Joseph," he said, quite gently. "Is someone dead, then?"
Mr. Weems sank his face into his hands, head shaking to and fro like a metronome. He muttered something which I understood to be,
"Better if she were."
"Lizzie?" I asked, exchanging a puzzled glance with Jamie. "Is it Lizzie, you mean?" "She'd been perfectly all right at breakfast. What on earth?"
"First Manfred MacGillivray," Mr. Weems said, raising his face from his hands. "And then Higgins. As though a degenerate and a murderer were not bad enough. Know this?"
Jamie's brows shot up and he looked at me. I shrugged slightly. The gravel was jabbing sharply into my knees. I rose stiffly and brushed it away. "Are you saying that Lizzie is, in love with someone unsuitable?" I asked carefully. Mr. Weems shuddered.
"Unsuitable,"
he said, in a hollow tone.
"Jesus Christ! Unsuitable!"
I'd never heard Mr. Weems blaspheme before. It was unsettling. He turned wild eyes on me, looking like a crazed sparrow huddled in the depths of Jamie's cloak.
"I gave up everything for her," he said. "I sold myself, and gladly, to save her from dishonour. I left home, left Scotland, knowing I should never see it more, that I should leave my bones in the soil of the strangers. And yet I've said nae word of reproach to her, my dear wee lassie, for how should it be her fault? And now..."
He turned a hollow, haunted gaze on Jamie.
My God, what shall I do?" he whispered.
A blast of wind thundered through the rocks and whipped the cloak around him, momentarily obliterating him in a shroud of grey, as though distress had quite engulfed him. I kept tight hold of my own cloak to prevent it being torn off me. The wind was strong enough that I nearly lost my footing. Jamie squinted against the spray of dust and fine gravel that had blasted us, setting his teeth in discomfort. He wrapped his arms around himself, shivering.
"Is the lass with child, then, Joseph?"
he said, obviously wanting to get to the bottom of things and go home. Mr. Weems' head popped out of the folds of cloak, fair hair tousled into broom straw. Blinking reddened eyes, he nodded, then excavated the jug, and, raising it in trembling hands, took several gulps. I saw the single X marked on the jug. With his characteristic modesty, he had taken a jug of the raw new whiskey, not the cask-aged higher quality. Jamie sighed, reached out a hand, and, taking the jug from him, took a healthy gulp himself.
"Who?" he said, handing it back. "Is it my nephew?"
Mr. Weems stared at him, owl-eyed.
"Your nephew?"
"Ian Murray," I put in helpfully,
Tall, brown-haired lad. Tattoos?
Jamie gave me a look suggesting that I was perhaps not being quite so helpful as I thought. But Mr. Weems went on looking blank.
Ian Murray.
Then the name appeared to penetrate through the alcoholic fog.
Oh, no. Christ, if it were, I should bless the lad, he said fervently.
I exchanged another look with Jamie. This looked like being serious.
Joseph,
he said, with just a touch of menace.
It's cold.
He wiped his nose on the back of his hand.
Who's debauched your daughter? Give me his name, and I'll see him wed to her in the morning, or dead at her feet, whichever you like. But let's do it inside by the fire, aye?
Beardsley,
Mr. Weems said in a tone suggesting visions of utter despair.
Beardsley,
Jamie repeated. He raised one eyebrow at me. It wasn't what I would have expected, but hearing it came as no great shock either.
Which Beardsley was it?
He asked, with relative patience.
Joe or Kezi?
Mr. Weems heaved a sigh that came from the bottoms of his feet.
She doesn't know,
he said flatly.
Christ,
said Jamie involuntarily. He reached for the whiskey again and drank heavily.
Ahem,
I said, giving him a meaningful look as he lowered the jug. He surrendered it to me without comment and straightened himself on his boulder, shirt plastered against his chest by the wind, his hair whipped loose behind him.
Well then,
he said firmly,
we'll have the two of them in and find out the truth of it.
No, said Mr. Weems, we won't. They don't know either.
I had just taken a mouthful of raw spirit. At this I choked, spluttering whiskey down my chin.
They what?
I croaked, wiping my face with a corner of my cloak.
You mean both of them?
Mr. Weems looked at me. Instead of replying, though, he blinked once. Then his eyes rolled up into his head, and he fell headlong off the boulder, poleaxed. I managed to restore Mr. Weems to semi-consciousness, but not to the point of his being able to walk. Jamie was therefore obliged to carry the little man slung across his shoulders like a deer carcass. No mean feat, considering the broken ground that lay between the whiskey cache and the new malting floor, and the wind that pelted us with bits of gravel, leaves, and flying pine cones. Clouds had boiled up over the shoulder of the mountain, dark and dirty as laundry suds, and were spreading rapidly across the sky. We were going to get drenched if we didn't hurry. The going became easier once we reached the trail to the house, but Jamie's temper wasn't improved by Mr. Weems suddenly coming to at this point and vomiting down the front of his shirt. After a hasty attempt at swabbing off the mess, we reorganized our strategy and made our way with Mr. Weems precariously balanced between us, each firmly gripping one elbow as he slipped and stumbled, his spindly knees giving way at unexpected moments, like Pinocchio with his strings cut. Jamie was talking to himself volubly in Gaelic under his breath during this phase of the journey, but desisted abruptly when we came into the dooryard. One of the Beardsley twins was there, catching chickens for Mrs. Bug before the storm. He had two of them, held upside down by the legs like an ungainly bouquet of brown and yellow. He stopped when he saw us, and stared curiously at Mr. Weems.
What? Began the boy.
He got no further. Jamie dropped Mr. Weems's arm, took two strides, and punched the Beardsley twin in the stomach with sufficient force that he doubled over, dropped the chickens, staggered back, and fell down. The chickens flapped off in a cloud of scattered feathers, squawking. The boy writhed about on the ground, mouth opening and closing in a vain search for air. But Jamie paid no attention. He stooped, seized the lad by the hair, and spoke loudly and directly into his ear. In case it was Kezi, I supposed.
Fetch your brother. To my study. Now.
Mr. Weems had been watching this interesting tableau, one arm draped across my shoulders for support, and his mouth hanging open. It continued to hang open as he turned his head, following Jamie as he strode back toward us. He blinked, though, and shut it, as Jamie seized his other arm, and removing him neatly from me, propelled him into the house without a backward glance. I gazed reproachfully at the Beardsley on the ground. "How could you?" I said. He made soundless goldfish mouths at me, his eyes completely round, then managed a long sound of inhalation, his face dark purple.
"Joe, what's the matter? Are you hurt?"
Lizzie came out of the trees, a pair of chickens clutched by the legs in either hand. She was frowning worriedly at, well, I suppose it was Joe. If anyone could tell the difference, it would surely be Lizzie. "No, he's not hurt," I assured her, "yet." I pointed a monitory finger at her. "You, young lady, go and put those chickens in their coop, and then..." I hesitated, glancing at the boy on the ground who had recovered enough breath to gasp and was gingerly sitting up. I didn't want to bring her into my surgery, not if Jamie and Mr. Weems were going to be eviscerating the Beardsleys right across the hall. "I'll go with you," I decided hastily, gesturing her away from Joe. "Shoo!"
"But..."
She cast a bewildered glance at Joe. Yes, it was Joe. He ran a hand through his hair to get it out of his face, and I saw the scarred thumb. "He's fine," I said, turning her toward the chicken coop with a firm hand on her shoulder. "Go." I glanced back to see that Joe Beardsley had made it to his feet, and, with a hand pressed to his tender middle, was making off toward the stable, presumably to fetch his twin, as ordered. I glanced back at Lizzie, giving her a narrow eye. If Mr. Weems had the right end of the stick, and she was pregnant, she was evidently one of those fortunate persons who doesn't suffer from morning sickness or the usual digestive symptoms of early pregnancy. She was, in fact, very healthy-looking. That in itself should have alerted me, I supposed, pale and green-stick as she normally was. Now that I looked carefully, there seemed to be a soft pink glow about her, and her pale blonde hair was shiny where it peeped out under her cap. "How far along are you?" I asked, holding back a branch for her. She gave me a quick look, gulped visibly, then ducked under the branch.
"About 4 months gone, I think," she said meekly, not looking at me. "Da told you, did he?"
"Yes. Your poor father," I said severely. "Is he right? Both of the Beardsleys?" She hunched her shoulders a little, head bowed, but nodded almost imperceptibly.
What will himself do to them?" she asked, her voice small and tremulous.
"I really don't know." I doubted that Jamie himself had formed any specific notions, though he had mentioned having the miscreant responsible for Lizzie's pregnancy dead at her feet if her father wished it. Now that I thought, the alternative, having her wed by morning, was likely to be somewhat more problematic than simply killing the twins would be. "I don't know," I repeated. We had reached the coop, a stoutly built edifice that sheltered under a spreading maple. Several of the hens, slightly less stupid than their sisters, were roosting like huge ripe fruits in the lower branches, heads buried in their feathers. I pulled open the door, releasing a gust of ripe ammonia from the dark interior, and, holding my breath against the stink, pulled the hens from the tree and tossed them brusquely inside. Lizzie ran into the woods nearby, snatching chickens out from under bushes and rushing back to shove them in. Large drops were beginning to plummet from the clouds, heavy as pebbles, making small audible splats as they struck the leaves above. "Hurry!" I slammed the door behind the last of the squawking chickens, threw the latch, and seized Lizzie by the arm. Borne on a whoosh of wind, we ran for the house, skirts whirling up round us like pigeons' wings. The summer kitchen was nearest. We burst through the door just as the rain came down with a roar, a solid sheet of water that struck the tin roof with a sound like anvils falling. We stood panting inside. Lizzie's cap had come off in flight, and her plait had come undone, so that her hair straggled over her shoulders in strands of shining, creamy blonde, a noticeable change from the wispy, flyaway look she usually shared with her father. If I had seen her without her cap, I should have known at once. I took time to recover my breath, trying to decide what on earth to say to her. She was making a great to-do over tidying herself, panting and pulling at her bodice, smoothing her skirts, all the while trying not to meet my eye. Well, there was one question that had been niggling at me since Mr. Ween's shocking revelation. Best to get that one out of the way at once. The initial roar of the rain had slackened to a regular drumbeat. It was loud, but conversation was at least possible. "Lizzie." She looked up from her skirt settling, slightly startled. "Tell me the truth," I said. I put my hands on either side of her face, looking earnestly into her pale blue eyes. "Was it rape?" She blinked, the look of absolute amazement that suffused her features more eloquent than any spoken denial could have been. "Oh, no, ma'am," she said, just as earnestly. "You couldn't think Joe or Kezzy would do such a thing." Her small pink lips twitched slightly. "What? Did you think they maybe took it in turns to hold me down?" "No," I said tartly, releasing her. "But I thought I'd best ask, just in case." I hadn't really thought so, but the Beardsleys were such an odd mix of the civil and the feral that it was impossible to say definitely what they might or might not do. "But it was, both of them. That's what your father said." "Poor man," I added, with a tone of some reproach. "Oh." She cast down her pale lashes, pretending to find a loose thread on her skirt. Well, aye, it was. I do feel something terrible about shaming Da so. And it wasn't it really that we did it a purpose?" "Elizabeth Weems," I said, with no little asperity. "Rape aside, and we've ruled that out, it is not possible to engage in sexual relations with two men without meaning to. One maybe, but not two." "Come to that," I hesitated, but vulgar curiosity was simply too much. "Both at once?" She did look shocked at that, which was something of a relief. "Oh, no, ma'am. It was... I mean, I didn't ken that it..." She trailed off, quite pink in the face. I pulled two stools out from under the table and pushed one toward her. "Sit down," I said, "and tell me about it. We aren't going anywhere for a bit," I added, glancing through the half-open door at the downpour outside. A silver haze rose knee-high over the yard as the raindrops struck the grass in small explosions of mist, and the sharp smell of it washed through the room. Lizzie hesitated, but took the stool. I could see her making up her mind to it, that there was really nothing to do now but explain, assuming that the situation could be explained. "You, said you didn't know," I said, trying to offer her an opening. "You mean, you thought it was only one twin, but they, fooled you?" "Well, aye," she said, and took a huge breath of the chilly air. "Something like that. See, 'twas when you and himself went to Bethabara for the new goat. Mrs. Bug was down with a lumbago, and it was only me and Da in the house. But then he went down to Woolham's for to fetch the flour, and so it was just me." "To Bethabara? That was 6 months ago, and you're 4 months gone. You mean all this time you've been..." "Well, never mind." "What happened then?" "The fever," she said simply. "It came back." She'd been gathering firewood when the first malarial chill struck her. Recognizing it for what it was, she had dropped the wood and tried to reach the house, only to fall halfway there, her muscles going slack as string. "I lay upon the ground," she explained, "and I could feel the fever coming for me. It's like a great beast, aye. I can feel it seize me in its jaws and bite. 'Tis like my blood runs hot and then cold, and the teeth of it sink into my bones. I can feel it set in then, to try to break them in twa and suck the marrow." She shuddered in memory. One of the Beardsleys, she thought it was Kezzy, but had been in no state of mind to ask, had discovered her lying in a dishevelled heap in the dooryard. He'd run to fetch his brother, and the two of them had raised her, carried her between them into the house, and fetched her upstairs to her bed. "My teeth were clacking so hard together I thought they'd break, surely. But I told them to fetch the ointment with the gallberries. The ointment you'd made." They had rummaged through the surgery cupboard until they found it, and then, frantic, as she burned hotter and hotter, had stripped off her shoes and stockings, and began to rub the ointment into her hands and feet. I told them they must rub it all over," she said, her cheeks going a deep peony. She looked down, fiddling with a strand of hair. I was quite oot in my mind wi' the fever, ma'am. Truly I was. But I kent I needed my medicine bad." I nodded, beginning to understand. I didn't blame her. I'd seen the malaria overpower her. And so far as that went, she'd done the right thing. She did need the medicine, and couldn't have managed to apply it herself. Frantic, the two boys had done as she'd said, got her clothes awkwardly off, and rubbed the ointment thoroughly into every inch of her naked body. "I was going in and out a bit," she explained, "wi' the fever dreams walking oot my head and about the room, so it's all a bit mixed, what I recall. But I do think one of the lads said to the other, as he was getting the ointment all over, and would spoil his shirt, 'Best take it off.'"
"I see," I said, seeing vividly. "And then?"
And then she had quite lost track of what was happening, save that whenever she drifted to the surface of the fever, the boys were still there, talking to her and each other, the murmur of their voices a small anchor to reality, and their hands never leaving her, stroking and smoothing, and the sharp smell of gallberries cutting through the wood smoke from the hearth, and the scent of beeswax from the candle. "I felt safe," she said, struggling to express it. "I don't remember much in particular, only opening my eyes once and seeing his chest right before my face, and the dark curlies all round his paps, and them wee and brown and wrinkled, like reasons." She turned her face to me, eyes still rounded at the memory. "I can still see that, like as it was right in front of me this minute. That's queer, no?"
"Yes," I agreed,
"though in fact it wasn't. There was something about high fever that blurred reality, but at the same time could sear certain images so deeply into the mind that they never left."
"And then?"
Then she had begun to shake violently with chills, which neither more quilts nor a hot stone at her feet had helped. And so one of the boys, in desperation, had crawled under the quilts beside her and held her against him, trying to drive out the cold from her bones with his own heat, which, I thought cynically, must have been considerable at that point. "I dinna ken which it was, or if it was the same one all night, or if they changed now and then. But whenever I woke, he was there, wi' his arms about me. And sometimes he'd put back the blanket and rub more ointment down my back, and round." She stumbled, blushing. "But when I woke in the morning, the fever was gone, like it always is on the second day." She looked at me, pleading for understanding. "Do you ken how that is, ma'am, when a great fever's broken? 'Tis the same every time, So I'm thinking it may be so for everyone, but it's peaceful.
Your limbs are so heavy, you cannot think of moving, but you dinna much care. And everything you see, all the wee things you take nae notice of day by day, you notice, and they're beautiful, she said simply. I think sometimes that will be how it is when I'm dead. I shall just wake, and everything will be like that, peaceful and beautiful. See if I shall be able to move.
But you woke this time and couldn't, I said. And the boy, whichever it was, he was still there with you.
It was Joe, she said, nodding. He spoke to me, but I didn't pay much mind to what he said. And I didn't think he did either.
She bit her lower lip momentarily, the small teeth sharp and white.
I hadn't done it before, ma'am. But I came close a time or two wi' Manfred, and closer still wi' Bobby Higgins. But Joe hadn't ever even kissed a lass, nor his brother had either. So you see, 'twas really my fault, for I kent well enough what was happening, but we were both slippery with the ointment still, and naked under the quilts, and it happened.
I nodded, understanding precisely and in detail. Yes, I can see how it happened all right. But then it, went on happening, I suppose. Her lips pursed up, and she went very pink again.
Well, it did. It feels so nice, ma'am, she whispered, leaning a little toward me as though imparting an important secret.
I rubbed a knuckle hard across my lips. Yes, quite. But the Beardsleys had washed the sheets at her direction, and there were no incriminating traces left by the time her father returned 2 days later. The Gallberries had done their work, and while she was still weak and tired, she told Mr. Weems only that she had had a mild attack. Meanwhile, she met with Joe at every opportunity, in the deep summer grass behind the dairy shed, in the fresh straw in the stable, and when it rained, now and then, on the porch of the Beardsleys' cabin.
I wouldn't do it inside for the stink of the hides, she explained. But we put an old quilt on the porch so I shouldn't have splinters in my backside, and the rain coming down just a foot away.
She looked wistfully through the open door, where the rain had softened into a steady whisper, the needles trembling on the pine trees as it fell.
"And what about Kezzy? Where was he while all this was going on?" I asked.
"Ah, well, Kezzy," she said, taking a deep breath.
They had made love in the stable, and Joe had left her lying on her cloak in the straw, watching as he rose and dressed himself. Then he had kissed her and turned to the door. Seeing that he had forgotten his canteen, she called softly after him.
"And he didn't answer, nor turn round," she said. "And it came to me suddenly, as he didn't hear me."
"Oh, I see," I said softly. "You, couldn't tell the difference?"
She gave me a direct blue look.
"I can now," she said.
In the beginning, though, sex was so new, and the brothers both sufficiently inexperienced, that she hadn't noticed any differences.
"How long?" I asked. "I mean, do you have any idea when they,
"Not for certain," she admitted. "But if I was to guess about it, I think the first time it was Joe. No, I ken for sure that it was Joe, for I saw his thumb. But the second time, it was likely Kezzy. They share, Ken?"
"They did share. Everything. And so it was the most natural thing in the world, to all three of them, evidently, that Joe should wish his brother to share in this new marvel."
"I ken it seems strange," she said, shrugging a little. "And I suppose I ought to have said something or done something, but I couldna think what. And really," she raised her eyes to me, helpless, "it didn't seem wrong at all. They're different, aye, but at the same time, they're so close to each other.
Well, it's just as if I was touching the one lad and talking to him. Only he's got the twa bodies.
Twa bodies, I said, a little bleakly.
Well, yes. There's just the difficulty, you see. The two bodies part. I eyed her closely. Despite the history of malaria and her fine-boned build, she had definitely filled out. She had a plump little bosom swelling over the edge of her bodice, and while she was sitting on it, so I couldn't tell for sure, very likely a bottom to match. The only real wonder was that it had taken her 3 months to fall pregnant. As though reading my mind, she said,
I took the seeds, I, the ones you and Miss Bree take. I had a store put by from when I was betrothed to Manfred. Miss Bree gave me them. I meant to gather more, but I did not always remember, and...
She shrugged again.